This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Dr. Lewis V. Baldwin is currently a professor of religious studies at Vanderbilt University. He was a student at Colgate, Rochester, Bexley Hall, Crozier Theological Seminaries from 1971 to 1975, receiving the Master's of Arts degree in Black Church Studies in 1973 and the Master of Divinity degree in Theology in 1975. He entered the PhD program in American Christianity at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, in the fall of 1975, completing the requirements for the degree in 1980. While pursuing the PhD, Dr. Baldwin was ordained into the ministry at Pine Level No. 2 Baptist Church in Greenfield, Alabama, on December 31, 1978, by his father, Pastor L.V. Baldwin, Sr. He was also ordained a deacon in the Tennessee Conference of the United Methodist Church on June 16, 1987. Dr. Baldwin has preached and lectured at colleges, universities, seminaries, and churches throughout the United States and abroad. In 2007, Dr. Baldwin served as a special lecturer and panelist at the Martin Luther King Jr. International Conference in Rome, Italy, an event co-sponsored by the Union Cristiana Evangelical Battista d'Italia and the Lac Carré Baptist Foreign Mission Convention in Washington, D.C. Dr. Baldwin is the author of numerous books and book chapters, articles, and book reviews, and of several monographs and books. Among his recent books and monographs are Between Cross and Crescent, Christian and Muslim Perspectives on Malcolm and Martin, 2002, with Amiri Yassin al-Hadid, Plenty Good Room, a Bible study based on African American spirituals, 2002, Never to Leave Us Alone, The Prayer Life of Martin Luther King Jr., 2010, and The Voice of Conscience, The Church in the Mind of Martin Luther King Jr., 2010. Dr. Baldwin is currently working on several additional titles, and I'm only going to name a few, on the life and thought of Dr. King, three of which will result from collaborative efforts. They include A Drum Major for Justice, Essays in Memory of Martin Luther King Jr., In a Single Garment of Destiny, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Globalization of an Ethical Ideal, The Word Made Flesh, the Bible as a Source of Martin Luther King Jr., The Domestication of Martin Luther King Jr., Clarence B. Jones, Right-Wing Conservatism, and the Manipulation of the King Legacy. And he's actually writing this, co-editing this with my mentor, Dr. Rufus Burrell Jr., at Christian Theological Seminary. Dr. Baldwin has received numerous other honors and awards. I won't go through them all here, from academic institutions, churches, community, and cultural centers, and local, regional, national politicians for his preaching, teaching, and scholarship. This evening, Dr. Baldwin will speak on the topic, The Spirituality of Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement, an Enduring Legacy. Please join me in offering a Spokane and Whitworth welcome to Dr. Baldwin.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. First, I want to extend greetings to all of you who are present here this evening. I want to acknowledge the president, Beck Taylor, in his absence. I'm assuming that he's not here tonight. I want to acknowledge faculty members, administrative staff persons, students, visitors, and friends. I am so delighted and honored to be here on the campus of Whitworth University an institution known for its rich history and for its traditions of academic excellence. I owe a special word of gratitude to the members of the History Department, to the Office of Academic Affairs, the Office of Institutional Advancement, to my friend Dr. Lawrence Burnley and others in the Center for Diversity and Intercultural Relations, and others for the invitation to serve as the 2013 Simpson DeVall Lecturer. I think it's wonderful that in February 2013, you have been able to create what Dr. Burnley calls a programmatic thematic bridge between your Black History Month and Martin Luther King Jr. celebrations, and your tribute to the lives, the work, and the legacies of Clarence Simpson and Aura Fenton Duvall. When we look seriously at the lives of Simpson and Duvall, we find echoes of the same values that were dear to Carter G. Woodson, the father of Black History Month, and Martin Luther King Jr. All of these men epitomize the integration of faith and learning, so it is only fitting that we mention them all in the same vein. But I have chosen to talk this evening about the spirituality of Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement and enduring legacy. Many deep thoughts, many deep reflections crowd in upon us as we remember Dr. King, a man dedicated and righteous in his generation, a man who walked across the stage of history and who left a record of struggle, of service and achievement that shall endure with undying radiance across the annals of time. Martin Luther King Jr. It is a name synonymous with commitment, a name synonymous with altruism and sacrifice. We recall the power of Dr. King's presence and personality. We recall his compelling spiritual and intellectual vitality, the majestic quality of his preaching, the epic character of his life, and his sterling record as a voice of advocacy and reason for the poor and oppressed across this land and abroad. Needless to say, Dr. King has affected each of us indelibly and in profound ways, but we still have not assessed and analyzed fully the true meaning of his rich life and his enduring legacy. Too many Americans are still unclear about who Dr. King was, about what we should expect of him as a cultural hero and icon, and about what he might expect and think of us in this age of globalization. The King scholar Luther D. Ivory has repeatedly alluded to the multiple and competing portrayals of Dr. King that continue to generate mass confusion in the public square. I am convinced this evening that there is a need to rediscover and reclaim Dr. King because, as Vincent Harding and others have pointed out, King has gotten lost in our annual national celebrations of his birthday. Dr. King has appeared in recent studies of his life as a masterful orator and rhetorician, as a philosopher and theologian, and as a tireless and uncompromising advocate of nonviolent civil disobedience. I do not quarrel with these images of Dr. King, but I do find them grossly inadequate. My challenge as a King scholar is to move those who read my work toward a greater appreciation of Martin Luther King Jr. as a person of faith. That is to say that King was not only a great speaker, a great thinker, and nonviolent activist. He was the high priest of the freedom struggle, a modern day prophet, and what Gardner C. Taylor calls, quote, the one true spiritual genius which this land has produced, end quote. And so it is this depiction of Dr. King, the one true spiritual genius, that I am most concerned about here and now as I read him in his own context, as I reflect upon his meaningfulness and his relevance for us today. I believe that we get at the essence of Dr. King, the man, the person, when we highlight his significance as a paragon of godly devotion and as a beacon of an all-engaging and practical spirituality. From the very beginning of Dr. King's involvement in organized social protest in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955-56, his social vision was grounded in certain kinds of religious experiences and religious convictions. Many of you, I'm sure, have read Dr. King's stirring and unforgettable account of his vision in the kitchen in Montgomery in 1956. A sacred moment when he relied not on his own strength, but entrusted himself and the movement to what he called his divine companion, the Waymaker. It was in January 1956, as the fervor driving the Montgomery bus boycott reached fever's pitch, Dr. King received a telephone call from a white racist at midnight, who called him a nigger and threatened to blow up his home and to kill him and his family. Recalling that frightening and painful experience, King wrote, and I quote him at great length, "I got to the point where I couldn't take it any longer. I was weak. And something said to me, 'You can't call on Daddy now. He's up in Atlanta, 175 miles away. You can't call on Mama now. You've got to call on that something and that person that your daddy used to tell you about. That power that can make a way out of no way.' And I discovered then that religion had to become real to me, and I had to know God for myself. I bowed down over a cup of coffee that night. I never will forget it. Oh yes, I prayed a prayer. And I prayed out loud that night. I said, 'Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I think I'm right. I think the cause that we represent is right. But Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. And I can't let the people see me like this, because if they see me weak and losing my courage, they too will begin to get weak.'" Dr. King continues, quote, "It seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice saying to me, 'Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness, stand up for justice, stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you even unto the end of the world,'" end quote. I submit that this vision in the kitchen was Dr. King's Kairos moment. Indeed, the decisive moment that signaled an important shift in his life, thought, and activities. In that moment of quiet brooding, Dr. King found new life in prayer. And he was reminded that prayer indeed mattered. And King began to believe anew that the sovereign will and work of the Almighty was being manifested in both his own life and in the Montgomery bus boycott. That kitchen experience, and it is conceivable that Dr. King had other similar experiences from time to time, but that kitchen experience there in Montgomery enabled Dr. King sufficiently to carry out his work, even in the face of persecution, political harassment, and the many threats against his life. This is what sustained King in his commitment to nonviolent struggle. Dr. King was a spiritual leader who stood at the center of what he called a spiritual movement designed to address what he labeled a spiritual crisis in our society and culture. The motto of King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, to redeem the soul of America, had not only social, political, and economic implications, but also spiritual significance. And so that pilgrimage from Montgomery to Memphis, which we talk about so much each year in January, was essentially a spiritual pilgrimage. While King's preeminence in the civil rights field is commonplace and is the subject of numerous studies, his spiritual life remains unexplored terrain, an important and yet overlooked aspect of who and what he was. Mindful of this glaring omission in the scholarship on Dr. King, I decided over the last 3 years to publish 3 books treating King as a person of faith, whose social vision, political strategies, and social activism were intertwined with core spiritual values and a deep personal piety. One of my publications, The Voice of Conscience, The Church in the Mind of Martin Luther King Jr., issued by Oxford University Press in 2010, focuses on Dr. King's churchmanship and how he became the quintessential model of Christian activism in the 1950s and 60s. I also explain how King challenged the church around the need for a higher spiritual and ethical ideal, how he masterfully translated a deep and profound spirituality into sustained Christian social activism, and how his spiritual and moral leadership and his eventual martyrdom did so much to reestablish the credibility of the church in an age when theologians like William Hamilton and Thomas J.J. Altizer were declaring the death of God. The second book I authored, entitled Never to Leave Us Alone, The Prayer Life of Martin Luther King Jr., published by Fortress Press in Minneapolis in 2010, explains how Dr. King integrated spirituality and devotional practices with his everyday struggles for a better society and world. In other words, Never to Leave Us Alone treats Dr. King's prayer life not only as a vital expression of his spirituality, but also as an energizing and enabling force in the crusade for equal rights, social justice, human dignity, and peace. I am most concerned in this book about the connection King drew between prayer and the civil rights movement, and about how his conception of prayer as lived experience, as lived tradition, and as creative energy developed in the midst of conflict and action. And let me also say that my book, Never to Leave Us Alone, examines the ways in which Dr. King made prayer an all-commanding factor in his own personal life, from the point of his sermon preparation to the delivery of the sermon itself, from the fulfillment of his administrative and caring functions as a pastor, a religious leader, to the undertaking of his spiritual role as a priest, a ritual leader. And from those sanctified moments of quiet communication with God to the public exercise of his civil rights leadership in both congregational and larger communal contexts. And it is very clear to me that Dr. King experienced absolutely no tension in reconciling his devotion to spiritual values with his commitment to nonviolent struggle and acts of civil disobedience. My most recent publication is a collection of Dr. King's personal prayers, some 68 prayers recited in churches during mass meeting speeches and in the context of street demonstrations. Published by Beacon Press in Boston in 2012, this collection of prayers entitled Thou Dear God, Prayers That Open Hearts and Spirits, also highlights spirituality as a fundamental component of Dr. King's Christian social witness and praxis. Now these prayers capture and reflect the flavor and spark of Dr. King's spirituality. They tell us what he prayed for and about. And they show that Dr. King was emblematic of a deep, vital, and genuine spirituality. And let me also say that I feel that these prayers of Dr. King are a wonderful resource for assessing the spiritual depths of our own tradition. They could serve as a guide for understanding, exploring, and living out our own spiritual lives today. Growth and transformation in our own spiritual lives can indeed come from reading and savoring the spiritual words of others, and especially great souls like Dr. King. In any case, I wrote these three books on Dr. King, to which I just referred, for essentially four reasons. First, these works actually blossomed out of my long-standing interest in Dr. King's spirituality. Second, I was actually looking for some new and unique approach to King, some distinctive angle from which to assess and establish the precise meaning of his life. Third, I thought that these three books might generate some discussion in both academic and ecclesial circles about King's life as both a private person and a public figure. And if this were the case, King's studies or King's scholarship would perhaps be advanced to another level of sophistication. Fourth and finally, my three most recent publications on King emerged out of the conviction that the more substantive significance of King's life and legacy was his seemingly desperate dependence on a power beyond himself and his unquestionable commitment to a cause that would ultimately depend on the God of history and not on his own greatness. And so I say again that it is time that we move beyond the usual preoccupation with Dr. King as a civil rights leader to a greater appreciation of him as a spiritual leader and a greater appreciation of his spiritual genius. Father Brian Massingale of Marquette University is right. We need to rethink, we need to recast our understanding of Martin Luther King Jr. to reestablish his rightful place as a significant and even pivotal figure in Christian spirituality. Now, from this point, I want to speak at greater length about what Father Massingale calls King's living faith, or his living or engaged spirituality, or his view of spirituality in relation to social transformation, with a particular focus on King as an exemplary voice and as an active presence in the life of the Christian church. And of course, in the last part of my talk, I will explain why I think that King's prophetic spirituality, not the entrepreneurial spirituality of today's mega churches, offer the best potential for much needed church reform in this 21st century. In other words, I will employ King's model of an all-engaging and practical spirituality and his prophetic social ethic to critique the contemporary megachurch phenomenon. Martin Luther King Jr. always questioned narrow and conventional understandings of the Christian church. Having an uncanny gift for conveying in word and deed what it means to live the Christian faith, Dr. King consistently critiqued the powerful and entrenched models of the church as bureaucracy and institution, while fully embracing the concept of the church as mission and movement. Moreover, King held that the mission of the church is never in and to itself as a body, but rather in and to the world in which it claims legitimacy and relevance. For Dr. King, even the worship experience in the context of church life should constitute a call to mission, a call to movement, a call to service. Thus, King devoted much of his public and private life to prayer, praying for divine guidance, and demonstrating ways in which the church might maximize its potential and effectiveness as a positive transforming force in society and in both the personal and collective lives of people. To be sure, Dr. King affirmed the indispensability of the church as a force for both personal and social transformation. And he was absolutely convinced that the civil rights movement, a movement rooted, as he said, in spiritual and moral discipline, was an extension of Christianity in its most priestly and prophetic forms. This is what King had in mind when he spoke of a living faith, when he spoke of an all-engaging or practical spirituality and the true ecclesia. Clearly, it was at the level of praxis that King engaged the spiritual, social, and political significance of the church. Ever mindful of the interactions between political and social policy issues of his day and the mission of the church, King insisted on the church's heavy and uncompromising involvements, not only as a base or staging point from which to press such spiritual and moral claims, but also as an arena of political activity and participation. King spoke of the church as a rallying point and a source of inspiration for social protest, and as a revolutionary vanguard in a crusade to redeem and reconcile humanity. One actually finds in Dr. King's speeches, sermons, and writings a range of ecclesia images, or images of the church. Not only the church as spiritual and moral guardian of society, but the church as the conscience of the state, the church as koinonia, the church as symbol of the beloved community, the whosoever will let him come church, the church as liturgical event and activity, the church as covenant community, as the body of Christ, and the list goes on and on and on. All of these ecclesia images speak to King's quest for a healthy and harmonious unity between his personal spirituality, his intellectual concerns, and the dimensions of his social vision and his social praxis. This is most evident, I think, in the ways in which Dr. King united the prayer circle and enlightened social gospelism and the picket line, as he pressed for a higher human and ethical ideal, for a more just, peaceful, democratic, and inclusive society. I contend that all of the prayer rallies, prayer pilgrimages, the prayer circles, prayer vigils, and all of the other prayer-focused activities in the civil rights movement were efforts on Dr. King's part to translate a certain understanding of spirituality and a certain ecclesia ideal into practical action and practical reality. The same might be said of Dr. King's sermons and his public mass meeting speeches, which touched the soul of this nation under the imagery of biblical faith, and which always underscored spiritual values that were so central to the movement. Now, one might legitimately question the extent to which King succeeded in moving the Christian church toward renewal, or toward a holistic, applied spirituality, and a more vital and prophetic role in our culture. But no one can honestly deny that Dr. King taught us so much about how we might construct a truly liberating and empowering church for today and tomorrow. And so when it comes to the question of the nature and mission of the church, or the proper role of the church in the public square, King, I believe, remains a model for reflection. I think you would all agree this evening that the definition of the church today is in a crisis. The very idea of church is increasingly an elusive phenomenon that more often than not defies definition and precise explication. And this definitional crisis, or this identity crisis, if you will, is attributable to a range of factors, including the ineptness of the church as a spiritual resource and as the custodian of the type of practical, engaged, living spirituality and faith for which Dr. King was so well known. We are witnessing in these times the emergence of new church models, the increasing divisions and manifold organizational forms, and the church's vastly diverse and ever-changing constituency. So much is being written about the electronic church, about the public or politicized church, about word of faith churches, the non-denominational church, the multicultural church, mega churches, and the extent of the diversity alone has increased the Christian church's uncertainty about its own identity and purpose. And interestingly enough, the megachurch phenomenon, with its emphasis on prosperity, praise, and personal enrichment themes, is rapidly becoming the model for spirituality and for how we do church in this society. But the megachurches constitute a mix of politics and spirituality that I believe Martin Luther King Jr. would find strange and unacceptable. King really wasn't interested in the kind of spiritualizing proclivity, the feel-good-about-yourself spirituality that the megachurches major in, waving hands, throwing handkerchiefs, standing in healing lines, running up and down church aisles. Even a casual study of King's prayer life, for example, makes this evident. The call to prayer for Dr. King involved much more than the act of praise and the quest for personal enrichment and satisfaction. The call to prayer for Dr. King was a call to action in the interest of justice and the common good. The discipline of prayer and the discipline of nonviolence interacted and influenced each other in King's personal life and in the context of his activities as a civil rights leader and social activist. Prayer time for Dr. King was not simply sacred time. It was also self-purification time. And this self-purification time always preceded his involvement in nonviolent direct action campaigns. King, like Mohandas K. Gandhi, spoke of four steps in any well-planned and well-timed direct action campaign. First, the collection of facts to determine if injustice exists. Second, attempts at negotiation with the powers that be. And if unsuccessful, third, self-purification. And finally, nonviolent direct action. And in this third step, self-purification, prayer and meditation, and occasional fasting, spirituality, figured prominently for Dr. King. This is what anchored Dr. King's social justice activism in and through the church. And I am convinced that King's conception and practice of prayer and meditation, his devotional life, offer some clues to how we as the church today might understand, define, and practically apply spirituality. In my own judgment, Dr. King's model of prophetic witness and mission, and of a living, engaged, practical spirituality, not the entrepreneurial spirituality of today's megachurches, holds the key to an authentically renewed and revitalized church. The megachurch phenomenon, on the whole, with its prosperity gospel, is not only elitist, capitalistic, and materialistic. It also lacks a vital, all-engaging, and practical spirituality. Dr. King offered a powerful alternative model for envisioning what constitutes the prophetic and spirit-driven church. And the need to reclaim that model could not be more important for the church as a whole, especially as that church confronts both a crisis of values and serious questions about its meaning, its relevance, and its reliability in this ever-changing society and world. And especially in times when there is a growing distrust of institutions in general, including the church. Martin Luther King Jr.'s prophetic vision and activism, which was rooted, of course, in a vital personal piety, can be useful not only in reawakening and reforming the contemporary Christian church, but also, and perhaps more importantly, in making the church a powerful and effective vehicle in creating and sustaining a culture of life, a culture of openness and enlargement, a culture of radical democracy, a culture of peace and nonviolence, a culture of sacrificial servanthood, and a culture of constructive self-criticism. During the last year of his life, Dr. King lamented what he called a spiritual and moral lag in our culture, which needed to be redeemed. He saw and actually said in his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos of Community, that all of this nation's power and might and all of its material abundance had brought us neither peace of mind nor serenity of spirit. King wrote, and I quote him, "The richer we have become materially, the poorer we have become spiritually and morally." And so Dr. King spoke of the need for a genuine spiritual and moral awakening as a way of living creatively, not only in this country, but in what he called the World House. King reminded us that all inhabitants of the globe are now neighbors, that we are part of a World House, our worldwide neighborhood, due in part to our modern scientific and technological revolution. "We have become one physically," Dr. King declared, "but not one spiritually." And when King called for a spiritual and moral awakening, he was talking about a revolution of values, about shifting from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, about moving beyond the idea that self-preservation is the first law of life to the conviction that other preservation is the first law of life. He was talking about embracing loyalties that are ecumenical rather than sectional in scope, about lifting neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation, and calling for an all-embracing and unconditional love for all humankind. King was actually speaking here about radical, costly discipleship as our ultimate calling, about sharing in the sacrificial life of Jesus Christ. And I might add that this is why he spoke of his own struggle and the struggle of every authentically moral and rational creature in terms of bearing the cross. King has much to say to those people of faith, and especially Christians, who construct edifices to shield themselves from any and all forms of crucifixion, and who ignore the biblical connection between personal faith, radical unselfishness, and sacrificial service. Dr. King, I think, still challenges us to find the audacity to not only believe, but to hope, to struggle, to serve, to sacrifice, together for God's promised future. This, I think, is his spiritual legacy. And it is an invitation to all people everywhere to be a part of the realization of the kingdom of God on earth. Thank you.